As David said, I'm going to talk about a particular view of the brain, I hope one which is an engaging one, an enjoyable one, and I think you'll see why it's a view that has its origins in thinking about the world like a physicist. I want to start by reminding you that the interaction between physics and biology, and physics and the study of the brain in particular, goes back a long ways. When you go to a university today, we have separate departments for physics and chemistry and biology and mathematics. When some of these great figures of classical physics were at work, these boundaries were much less sharp. One of my favorite examples is Mr. Helmholtz here. I don't know whether I actually use it. Never quite got used to laser pointers. Helmholtz once gave a lecture on the unification of the sciences. And given his background and what we know of his accomplishments, he's of course well known for things that he did in the core of 19th century physics, but he's also the author of the great textbook on physiological optics. He's the author of a famous book on the sensations of tone, which is a mathematical exploration of the mechanics of the inner ear and the rules of harmony and music and so on. You might think that his notion of the unification of the sciences was roughly something that we might today call neuroscience, some combination of physiology and psychology, with physics. But that's not what he meant by the unification of the sciences, because for Helmholtz, these were already unified. He didn't see a big gap between understanding optics and understanding vision, or understanding sound and understanding hearing. So for him, that was all continuous. What he actually was referring to when he talked about the unification of the sciences was the natural sciences on the one hand, and aesthetics on the other. And he felt that if we really understood the dynamics of how we perceive the world, the sensors that we carry around in order to measure what's going on around us, what we would now call the algorithms that we use to process all of that information, we would understand not only that we happen to see certain things in certain ways, we would really understand why we see certain things as being beautiful. Well, we still have a long way to go, but it was perhaps an early example of the arrogance of physicists, but a charming one, I think, and one that still has an appeal, right? That perhaps what we see as beautiful, what we find appealing aesthetically, is not arbitrary. There are reasons for it. So, as I said, for these guys and their contemporaries, there is in fact an Ohm's law in acoustics. It's the same Ohm of the Ohm's law of electrical circuits. And it's about your perception of sound. It's the fact that you're phase deaf in one ear. For these guys, the boundary between these sorts of traditional physics subjects on the one hand and the subjects of our perception, our sensation, there really wasn't a sharp boundary. And I think that this is because they understood that the senses are, after all, our physical instruments that we use for making measurements on the world. It's how we know what's going on in the real physical world out there. And so if we're interested in the physical world, we should be interested in how our senses work. But they also understood that there was kind of more to that. It wasn't just a matter of perceiving the immediate state of the world. We also use the data that we collect through our eyes and our ears and our hands, even our noses, although they didn't spend much time thinking about that, to learn the rules that govern the dynamics of the world. And so in a sense, the understanding of our sensory data is like the process of discovery in science itself. We're observing a complicated world, we collect data about that world, and we reach some conclusions about what's going on around us. And so they were interested not just, as I say, in how we manage to detect a sound, but they were also ultimately interested in how we learn about the world. So let me tell you one experiment that dates from this period, because it maybe has some of the flavor that we'd like to get across. So Rayleigh, great theorist of acoustics, of sound, was interested, among other things, in how we know where sounds are coming from. So you all know that if someone snaps their fingers behind you, you can turn and point to where it is, where it was coming from, even though you didn't see it. So you can evidently localize the sound. You can point toward it. How do you do it? And there were various ideas floating around, but Rayleigh, having understood as much as he did about the equations that govern the propagation of sound in the air, and the way that propagation changes when it hits an object, like your head, understood that there are really, the first approximation, there are two cues for where sounds are coming from. One is that there is, for sound, the analog of a shadow. So you know that if you shine the light from over here, on my right, then if I had an eye over here on the back of my head on the left, it would be dark because my head is in the way. And the same is true for sound. If there's sound coming from this direction, it's louder on this side of my head than it is on this side. But Rayleigh understood that that's an effect which is only significant if the frequency of the sound wave is high enough. If the sound frequency gets low enough, there's no shadow. And the only way you can tell that the sound is coming from here and not from here is that if it's coming from this side, it actually arrives at your right ear a little bit before it arrives at your left ear, because the distance that it has to go is slightly different. Now, if you work out how big that difference in time is, the answer is that it's a few millionths of a second. So you might be suspicious that although this could be how you tell where the sound is coming from, it's never going to work, because no way can your brain make a measurement of time between your two ears, which is a few millionths of a second. So if you read the correct edition of The Theory of Sound and look in the back, you'll find the description of by then he was Lord Rayleigh, taking Lady Rayleigh out to the gazebo and sitting her down. One imagines the dress and the servants with the tea, but not described. And he sits her with two tubes coming out of her ears of different lengths, which come back together at a point where he can make a little spark. And now what's going to happen is that the sound of the spark is going to propagate along the tubes. And since one tube is a little longer than the other, it's going to come to one ear a little earlier than the other. And if this whole idea about timing is right, then if you ask Lady Rayleigh where did the sound come from, she'll point to the right if it got to her right ear earlier. And that works. And it works even when the difference in time is only a few millionths of a second. And had Lady Rayleigh been a barn owl, it would have been 1 millionth of a second. They're better at it than we are. Okay, let's jump. So the point of the story about Rayleigh, other than evoking a certain turn of the century image, is that the strategy that our brain uses for figuring out where the sound comes from, it's not arbitrary. You can't just do anything. At high frequencies, you have this intensity difference or shadow to work with. And by the way, actually at high frequencies, you don't want to measure the time difference because it turns out to be ambiguous. Whereas the intensity difference is actually a good cue. On the other hand, at low frequencies, there simply is no intensity difference, and that's not because biology doesn't decide to measure it, it's because it's not there physically. And so the strategies that our brain uses for processing the information that comes from our two ears, that we use so we can actually point to where something is coming from, the strategies are actually determined, or at least heavily constrained, by the physics of the world outside us. And there's this wonderful quote from Horace Barlow, who will reappear in a few slides. He's made a number of profound contributions to our understanding of vision, which I think summarizes this point very well. It's also nice because it's sometimes suggested that, you know, if you spent a lot of time learning how birds flew, you never would have figured out how to build airplanes, and so therefore you don't actually want to think about the physical principles behind biological systems. And well, it sort of has the thing turned on its head, right? If you'd actually like to understand why nature has generated organisms that look the way they do, you do have to understand something about the physics. So perhaps it's true that studying birds is a bad way to understand how to build airplanes, although you'll see in a moment that studying bats wouldn't have been a bad idea in understanding how to build radar or sonar. So the engineering question is complicated and has all sorts of historical issues tied up in it. But the question of understanding nature, I think, is reasonably clear. So let's talk about vision. For a physicist, the most striking fact about vision is that when it's dark outside, the fact that light is not a continuous wave, but rather is made out of discrete quanta called photons, that fact actually matters. And the reason it matters is because on a nice dark night, when you've had a long time to adapt, you can actually see when you can see with high confidence when about 5 or 6 photons arrive at your retina. And in fact, those 5 or 6 photons almost never arrive in the same cell in your retina. Your retina has, as you most of you know, 2 different kinds of cells that detect light: the cones, which you use during the daytime and are responsible for color vision; the rods, which are vastly more numerous, there are about 100 million of them in your retina, in each eye, and they function at night and don't provide you with any color. So every one of these cells, this one is from a creature that looks like this, who's included in this story only because he's kind of funny looking. It doesn't matter. A lot of the things that I'm going to say are true quite generally, many different organisms. One of these cells, when it absorbs one photon, will generate an electrical signal that makes a measurable contribution to whether you see anything or not. Now, this is quite remarkable because this cell, a few thousandths of an inch long, in order to absorb the light, there are 1 billion molecules of a pigment, of a protein called rhodopsin, which absorbs light. And when it absorbs light, it changes its structure, and that triggers a sequence of chemical reactions that eventually leads to a change in the electrical current flowing across this boundary of the cell called the membrane. And that change in electrical current eventually produces a change in voltage across the membrane at this end of the cell. That leads to the release of another molecule, which eventually triggers an electrical signal in the next cell, and so on. And after a couple stages of this, the signal leaves your eye along the optic nerve and finds its way to your brain. So one molecule out of 1 billion changing its structure, and the cell produces a detectable response. And in fact, under the right conditions, essentially, it's not too much of a stretch to say that you can see that. It's a slight fudge of the data, but it's not off by much. It's certainly the case that that makes a measurable contribution to your perception. Single molecule out of 1 billion. Now, that's pretty surprising. It means, for example, that the fact that photons arrive at your retina at random, and there's nothing you can do about that. That's the physics of the light bulbs that are around us. The physics of the way the sun emits light and it scatters off things and reaches our eye means that photons arrive at your retina at random. So you're looking at a perfectly still world where everything is the way it's supposed to be, but the signal that's getting to your eyes is fluctuating all the time. And that's physics, not biology. You just can't do anything about it. And so you have to do your best with that signal to try to make something out of it, literally to make sense out of it. So there's a huge number of problems here. And I apologize for the sort of laundry list approach, but let me just sort of point out a few of them. I don't really have time to go into any of them, but just to give a flavor. So I mentioned already that you have one molecule out of a billion molecules that you have to notice changed its structure. And that's pretty amazing. How do you make sure that a single molecular event produces a big enough response in the cell that it can actually do anything? And then if one molecule can do something, then when the lights go up and you've got thousands of molecules every second clicking over and absorbing light, how do you make sure that you're not just swamped by all of that? If you're sensitive enough to see one, what do you do when there's 1,000? It turns out that these signals, because they're small, making sure that you can actually get them from one layer of the retina to the next, so they can actually get out of the retina and up to your brain, that's not easy to do. It's very easy for these little signals to get lost. And in fact, a lot of people are interested in the question of how the circuitry of the retina is chosen or adapted or designed or selected, some of these words are dangerous, to be sure that these single photon signals are actually preserved. And in fact, we know that you have to do all sorts of trickery because, as I said, you don't want to just, when there aren't very many photons, it doesn't do you any good to notice, well, see, that cell didn't have one, and 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 that's, you don't want to do that, right? You want to look at a whole area and say, in that patch, there were 3 photons. So you have to collect lots of signals. But the signals are all small, and there's a little bit of background noise. How do you make sure that things don't get lost? There's a problem that the retina faces, which is an example of a problem that all cells in your body face. I'll remind you that the difference between the four different kinds of cells, the 3 different kinds of cones that give you color vision and the rod, the difference is that they have different proteins in them. They all have the same genes. Right? They all carry the same DNA, like every cell in your body. And so, presumably, what makes a red cone, and a green cone, is that the gene for the green rhodopsin is in one case turned on or off, and the red rhodopsin turned on or off. And actually, that turning on and off is done to an accuracy part, something like 1 part in 100,000. And actually, there's another problem, which is in the rhodopsin molecule itself. And indeed, many physicists who have gotten interested in vision never made it past rhodopsin. The rhodopsin molecule absorbs a photon, and then it changes its structure. And it had better be a big structural change, because this is going to trigger a whole sequence of chemical events. So you might ask the first question, how long does it take? So, you know, how do you tell? Well, you try to find some way of measuring that what the structure really is, or some signature of the structure. So you measure something about how it absorbs light, because the way molecules absorb light tells you something about the structure. So you give a little flash of light that triggers everything, and then you give a little more light and see what the absorption is like, and see if you can tell whether anything has changed. And so in the old days you did this, and you noticed that the structure changed in 1/1,000,000 of a second. And then came ways of turning lights on and off in 1/1,000,000 of a second. So everybody went back and did the experiment again. And it's 1/1,000,000 of a second. And then came pulsed lasers. And you could turn the lights on and off in 1/1,000,000 of a second. So they went back and did this experiment again. And in fact, this became one of the first experiments you did as soon as you got your new fast pulse laser. And it got faster. And in fact, by the time people like Shank and Ippen made these very clever chirped lasers in which you can turn the lights on and off, as it were, in 10 to the minus 15 seconds, so another factor of 1,000, whatever comes after 1,000,000,000,000. Well, now what you actually saw was you could actually now see the molecule moving in real time. And it was changing its structure in 1/100,000,000,000 of a second, and you could almost decipher from these measurements the movie. Changing its structure. And you look really carefully, and you notice that it changes its structure, and it comes back, It goes forward and back, and then it settles down. And you can just see a little bit of that coming back. What is the coming back? Well, in quantum mechanics, when you have a molecule that can have two states, it's not always true that you go irreversibly from one state to the other. You can be in these funny superpositions of states that many of you have probably heard about, like, you know, the famous example of Schrödinger's cat. And indeed, this molecule, on its way to doing the things that eventually trigger your seeing, passes through these funny quantum interfering states. You can see why some physicists never got past this. It's a remarkable thing. It is one of the fastest things that molecules are known to do. Any molecule. And it is a big, hulking molecule sitting in water. You can make little tiny molecules flying around in gas, not bumping into anything. You can make them do things pretty fast. But getting this big molecule sitting in water to do something in a hundredth of a trillionth of a second, it's not clear how that works. So this is a kind of survey of the kinds of problems that you might encounter in trying to understand one observation about the visual system. And these would be interesting questions about vision, but it turns out that they're much more general. The ultra-fast dynamics, in order to find another example of that, you need another place where you can sort of see that things are happening fast. And so the example is in photosynthesis, where again, light is absorbed and it triggers a sequence of chemical reactions. And again, you're just on the threshold of seeing these funny quantum interference effects. It's remarkable. It is one of the few places where quantum mechanics sort of touches function in biology in a very direct way, despite many fantasies in that direction. This is one of the few places where we actually know it happens. Now, physicists are interested in the universal, not the particular. It's a first approximation. As far as we know, the universe doesn't have any life in it. Now, of course, we're sort of interested in the deviation from that approximation, right? It's kind of important to us. Say, okay, we've agreed life is sufficiently interesting that despite the fact that it doesn't seem to be very common, we're going to study it anyway. So, you don't want to study some very peculiar organism that has all sorts of properties that are not shared with all the other organisms, right? Because that's not universal. So you'd like to study something that's typical of the organisms on the planet. Well, you might start by studying something that's typical of the organisms in this room, in which case you should study E. coli, which is the bacterium, one of the bacteria that lives in our gut, since each of us, of course, has roughly a billion of them, thus making them the most numerous organism in the room by a large margin. Now, I told you that when we see in the dark, when we see on a dark night, the cells in our eye are essentially counting individual molecules of rhodopsin. So if you look at the life of a bacterium, you notice that, in fact, they solve all sorts of molecule counting problems, too. In order to know how things are going in the environment, is there enough to eat? Are there the sugars that they like and not too many of the things they don't like? They have receptors on their surface to which various interesting molecules will bind. And when they bind, that again triggers some structural change in this molecule, which eventually leads to some signaling event inside the cell. And then that has various consequences. One of the consequences is that that molecule, which is created as a result of this structural change, this little round purple thing, might find its way to the other end of the bacteria and again bind to a receptor. But this receptor, instead of being on the outside of the cell, it's on the inside of the cell. Instead of sensing, as it were, how many interesting molecules there are outside, it's sensing how many of this particular kind of molecule there are inside. And what it does with that information is it decides which way this funny little object called a flagellum is going to spin. Bacteria swim by, they appear to swim by waving a flagellum, but it was discovered in the early 1970s, in large part as a result of the work of a physicist, Howard Berg, that in fact, what looks like something waving is actually a corkscrew rotating. And down here, on a scale of billionths of an inch, is a rotary engine. And the direction of that rotary engine is controlled by these internal chemical signals. And that has consequences for how the bacteria swim around, and eventually it helps them to find their way. But that's not all. Again, like us, they have one copy of their DNA, and although bacteria don't make multiple cells that do different things, at different times in their lives, they need to do different things. So whereas, you know, we have cells in our liver and cells in our brain that have completely different jobs, and so they have different genes that they're reading out to make the proteins, what a bacteria might find, it might find itself in an environment where it would be useful to make certain proteins and not others. And so the way that works is that there's a special place on the DNA. Let's say if this is the gene associated with making some particular protein for helping to eat a certain kind of sugar, and if that sugar is around, you need this little guy to run along and read out the information. And that's done with the help of another molecule that binds to some specific site. And if that's not there, then the reading won't happen. And so the way in which bacteria, and as far as to a large extent all organisms, but it's particularly clear in bacteria, regulate which molecules they actually make is, as it were, by counting the appearance of these signaling molecules, which are called transcription factors, as they arrive at particular sites along the DNA. So in all these different places, you're counting molecules. And it turns out that counting molecules isn't so easy, because they're diffusing around. They're kind of taking these random paths through the water, which is indicated here. The receptors are really small, so it takes a long time for a molecule to actually find its way to this spot. Doesn't happen very often. And you can't wait forever. You might think, well, okay, it's easy, right? One molecule comes, you write that down, you let it go, another molecule comes, and you gradually count how often do they come, right? But you can't wait forever to decide what to do. And so all of these constraints tell you that there are limits on how accurately the cell could ever know what the concentration of these interesting molecules in the environment is, how accurately it can control the rotary motor, how accurately it could turn genes on and off. And in fact, the performance of E. coli is very close to these physical limits in all these different cases, which is an argument that actually goes back, for this part of the problem, goes back again to Howard Berg and Ed Purcell in the 1970s. And many people have contributed since then. So this is another case where the limitations due to the laws of physics influence, at least sort of put bounds on what the organism can and can't do. And in fact, it turns out that there are aspects of how it does things that are constrained by the need to sort of squeeze down these limits so that they're as small as possible. So let's try another example. Let's go back to an animal with a brain, but one who sees the world very differently than we do. As most of you know, bats fly around and emit pulses of sound, very high frequency, so we don't hear them, ultrasound, and they listen for the echoes, much as in sonar. And so their view of the world is built out of these events where a pulse travels to something and comes back, travels to something and comes back. And so the way they know how far away something is by how long it takes the pulse to come back. So that means that if they're flying and they'd like to know where the walls are, which might be useful. By the way, you know, bats won't fly into your hair. And the reason is that if you take this room and you filled it with wire that was so thin, monofilament, that you know, fishing line, that was so thin that you couldn't see it, and the wires were spaced about like this, a bat would fly through it with no problem, because in fact, he can hear the echoes off of all the wires as the sound scatters off of it. So don't be afraid, but rather appreciate them because they eat the bugs. Now, in order to actually eat the bug, right, he's got to know where it is. And so he's got to be able to measure the time from the sound coming out it sort of comes out of his nose, but anyhow, the whole thing sort of projects out of his head, hitting the object and coming back to his ear, right? He's got to measure that time. So how accurately can he do that? So you might think, if you know something about how the nervous system works, you might think, well, 1/1000th of a second, because that's a kind of characteristic time for how cells in the brain are working. Dead wrong. There were a series of experiments done by Jim Simmons, who's now at Brown, in which he showed that you could get down to a 1/1000000th of a second. And then he said, oh, I know how this works. It's this complicated interference thing between the sound coming in and out, and it could blah, 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 blah. And everybody said, nonsense. If it really worked that way, you could do 100 times better. So it can't possibly work that way. And that number would correspond to 10 billionths of a second. And that's so obviously absurd that it can't be right, so it can't work this way. So Jim's a kind of remarkably stubborn guy, so he went and did the experiment, which, by the way, is very hard. How do you produce a controlled delay of sound on the time scale of 1/1000000th of a second? It's not so easy to do. You can't do it with your stereo, okay? And sure enough, that can detect a 10 nanosecond difference, 10 billionths of a second in the time of the pulse arrival. It is, I think, to judge by the reactions in the community and everything, this is one of the most startling things that I've ever heard said in a seminar. And actually, I got to hear it when he first found it. It was really astonishing. And I thought that it might be fun to remind ourselves, this has an interesting connection. The speed of light is 1 foot per nanosecond. Right? It's kind of useless unit. You're not supposed to think in feet, right? But you know, it's this much in 1/1000000th of a second. So 10 billionths of a second is, you know, a little further than I can reach. It's from here to where David's sitting. Now you may remember, if you've ever read anything about the history of physics, that Galileo, who did so many marvelous things, really, you know, sort of the founder of our subject, the guy who taught us that the book of nature is written in the language of mathematics, he tried to measure the speed of light. And he didn't get many things wrong. And actually, he didn't get this one wrong either, because he understood that he wasn't making a measurement. He was putting a bound on the speed of light. And the experiment was the following. He took two guys with lanterns, and he had them stand apart from each other. One guy opens his lantern. And he told the other guy, as soon as you see the light from his lantern, you open your lantern. And then you wait for it to come back, and then this guy, he knows when he opened his lantern, and then he sort of starts his stopwatch, although obviously he didn't have a stopwatch, but anyhow, turns over the timer. And then he says, ah, I saw the pulse of light come back, and then I look how long that was, and that's, you know, how long it took the light to go back and forth. Except, of course, that, you know, there's also the time for the guy to open the lantern, which is 1,000,000 times larger than the time for the light to go back and forth. But he knew that, or at least he knew that what he was measuring was the minimum speed of light. And he thought, I mean, the great advance, of course, is to realize that there was something to measure, right? That it didn't just happen instantaneously. You know, remember that it's not that long before that people thought that the light was coming out of our eye and going to the object, right? So this was progress. Anyhow, the interesting thing is that the timescale of precision and behavior that you would have needed in order for that experiment to actually work is the timescale that the bat has. Now, of course, the bat can't react in a nanosecond, right? But he can measure a time of 10 nanoseconds. And if you put noise in the background, so he's listening for his pulses, but it's going in the background, then, of course, as you turn up the background noise, it gets harder to do it, and you can calculate, if he does the best job he possibly can, how will things change, and it tracks. Okay. Here's one more, it's sort of this tour of examples of your sensory system. So, here's our friend Mr. Barlow again. This paper, Horace writes beautifully, and in this paper he notes that this problem, which is the perception of symmetry, is one of those gestalt phenomena that psychologists like to torture us with. Symmetry, beloved as it is by physicists, is not something that you can tell by looking at the parts of an object. It's a property of the whole. So I hope you can see that this thing, although a kind of random collection of dots, is not a random collection of dots. It's mirror symmetric. Right? Things on the left and on the right are the same. This, on the other hand, is a random collection of dots. However, you'll notice that, you know, if you squint a little bit, I don't know, there's a cluster over here and a cluster over there, and if you looked at those, and they're almost on the other side, and there's kind of a line over here and a line over there. And so this random collection of dots actually has little pieces that are on their way to being symmetric, as it were, by accident. And so you can imagine that if you were looking at something, and for some reason your view was a little obscured, so you didn't see all the parts, or maybe it wasn't perfectly symmetric, but it was almost symmetric, another thing that physicists like, then it might be that if you really looked at this, and then somebody else made something that was completely random, and you kind of counted the coincidental occurrences of something symmetric, you could be fooled. Not all the time, but some of the time. And so the question is, how good are you at solving this problem? How good are you at telling when you're looking at something that's really symmetric, as opposed to something that has little bits of symmetry by accident? And there's a limit to how well you can do, because, you know, you can sort of count up what's the odds that you'll find a certain number of coincidences across the line. And if I blur with individual dots, it's a little complicated, but if I blur things out a little bit, it gets more interesting to actually do that calculation. And it turns out that how well people do at solving this problem is almost as well as you can do in principle, given those rules of probability for how often you'll be fooled by accident. So these are various examples where what people or animals or bacteria do in solving various perceptual problems is close, their performance is close to some limit that comes from some basic physical characteristic of the signals that they're looking at. And there are related ideas in many other problems, including problems in pitch perception that I don't have time to talk about, but which are sort of appealing because of their connections to music and so on. So I think what I want to do is take you to one such problem and talk about it in a little bit of detail. And of course, it's a problem that's that I like because I've worked on it together with a number of friends. And that's vision in a fly. And we're going to talk about a particular part of a fly's visual system. We're going to talk about the part that allows him to estimate motion. Now, when you're walking along, one of the ways that you know whether you're going straight or tilting is that if you rotate, the world kind of seems to rotate around you visually. Now, usually we're not so aware of this because we'll counter-rotate our eyes, but flies don't do that. And so, and actually we don't always either. So one of the clues that a fly has to tell whether he's flying straight or whether he's turning is this apparent motion of the whole world around him. And there's a particular corner of his brain that turns out to be actually her brain. It's not political correctness. It actually matters. There's a particular corner of the fly's brain where you find the cells that are responsible for pulling out this signal about motion from all the data that it collects in these magnificent eyes that cover its head. So I think you all know that the little dots are actually separate lenses. Since we have one lens and they have many lenses, it leads to this problem. Now, this is a remarkable piece of data. It's one of the few cases I know where Gary Larson actually got something wrong about biology. What actually happens is that behind each lens, roughly speaking, this is exactly true, we'll see if Simon winces when I say it, there is one photodetector cell. Not exactly true, but close. So instead of the situation in our eye where you have one big lens, and in the back of the retina you have lots of cells, and each cell looks through the same lens, just like in your camera, all the pixels of the CCD, all the pixels of your digital camera are looking through the same lens. Imagine if you turned everything the other way and gave a separate lens to each pixel. And that's how the fly's eye is built. That has the disadvantage that the lenses are small, and so therefore they give you a very blurry image. On the other hand, it has the great advantage that the lenses are small. And so you'll notice that in order to build the eye in our configuration, the lens is here, the back of the eye is here, where the cells are, and all this is empty space. That empty space is approximately the size of a fly. So you can see these are very different solutions, right? Our solution gives us great resolution, but there's some wasted space in the eyeball. On the other hand, we're big animals, it doesn't matter. Okay? A fly, on the other hand, is spending a noticeable fraction of its energy carrying its eyes around, or its head around, which is mostly eye and brain to deal with the eyes. And so making things small is a good idea. So what we're going to talk about is listening in on the signals that are in the fly's brain that are concerned with motion. And we'll come back to this theme of what are the physical limits. What does physics tell us about how it can compute motion? But before I do that, I have to tell you that, you know, it is possible to listen in on the electrical signals that are generated by the nervous system. And this is true not only in flies and other convenient little organisms, it's true in us too. Now, if I were a real experimentalist instead of a masquerading theorist, the experiment I'd love to do for you is to listen in on the electrical signals coming from the receptors in your fingertips. It's a beautiful experiment. You put what is essentially an acupuncture needle in your arm about here, and it's metal, and metal, you know, makes contact with fluids in which there are electrical currents flowing, and you can pick them up. And you can literally stick a needle in your arm and record the signals on the nerve fibers as they come from the tips of your fingertips all the way back to your spinal cord. They pass by somewhere around here. And you can pick up the signals of individual nerve cells. And that's a beautiful experiment because you can show, for example, that if you're recording from the nerve cell that responds whenever you touch exactly this part of your fingertip, if you were to stimulate that nerve cell, inject a little electrical current, and I ask you, what did you feel? You would draw on your fingertip the place where the cell is sensitive. And more dramatically, these cells, like all cells in your body, produce discrete pulses called action potentials or spikes, like all the nerve cells in your brain. And whether you actually feel something at your fingertip or not is correlated with whether individual cells produce a spike or not. So you can really get down to the point where you're seeing, as it were, the atoms of your perception. Now, it's conceivable that we couldn't even get permission to do this in front of you, because, you know, it's a human subject and all that stuff, even if it's yourself. But I don't know how to do it. They tell me that it's not so bad, people who do. But I haven't even had acupuncture, so I don't know. But I'd like to do it someday. But this is much easier. So what we're going to do is just to convince you that there really are electrical signals moving around. Not only are there electrical signals, these pulses, action potentials, or spikes, that encode the sensory signals that are coming from your fingertips, your eyes, your ears, your nose. It's also true, of course, that when you want to move, you have to send signals back out. And the principles are the same. You send these discrete pulses out. So that means that if I want to tighten the muscles in my hand, I have to send spikes down the motor nerve fibers that eventually end on the muscles in my arm. So that when I'm standing here tightening and untightening my fist, I'm causing sort of a volley of spikes to travel down my arm. Now, your skin's not a perfect insulator, right? So if there are charges moving around, if there's electrical currents moving around inside, you might pick something up on the surface. And if you're in water, well, if you're in the air, it doesn't do very much. But if you're in water, currents can flow through the water too. And they can reach pieces of metal where they get picked up. So you have two pieces of metal sitting here. And what we do is we just measure the voltage in this piece of metal minus the voltage in this piece of metal. and we send it to a little amplifier, and from there we send it to the sound system and hope that it works. And so, of course, what we have here, in addition to the experiment we want to do, is an antenna. So you're picking up all sorts of noise, and that's too bad, because there's just nothing you can do about it. So let's give it a try. So all I'm doing is tightening my fist, not actually moving. So, you know, it's an experimental science, so you can come up and try it later. We have a large roll of paper towels. But you get the idea, I hope, that there are, in fact, electrical signals, and you can pick them up. Now, what you're hearing there, although, because in order to clench your fist, you sort of have to synchronize the activity of many muscles, so you kind of send a lot of things together. But you can imagine that what you'd really like to do is to tease apart the signals from individual cells, so you can really understand what's going on. So let's try this on the fly, and we'll get back and explain what's going on there in just a second. This is the experimental setup built by my colleagues, Rob DeGeiter and Jeff Lewin. Rob's been a collaborator for many, many years. Actually, from the year before I arrived here, even longer than my association with this place. This is a setup for recording from a fly. And if you look really closely, you can find the fly. He's down here. And she has a wire coming out the back of her head. And it goes to some electronics for processing things. And this has all been made very light. And the reason is that instead of doing the old-style experiment sort of setting the fly down in the lab and letting her watch TV. In this experiment, what Rob wanted to do was to get a little closer to the natural situation. Outside, where the lights are bright, the variations in light intensity are very strong. You know, the light intensity here and there are obviously very different from each other. And you'd also like to have the fly move in a way that's typical of the kind of dramatic, acrobatic flights that flies actually take. Flies can turn at thousands of degrees per second. They can change direction in a hundredth of a second, less. And it's hard to reproduce that in the lab. So what Rob's been working on is, I mean, there's a lot of experiments you can do in the lab, but what he's been working on is trying to get closer and closer to the natural situation. And so in this experiment, the whole apparatus is mounted on a motor drive. And you take it outside, and you fly the fly. Well, you almost fly the fly. You don't actually translate him. Because in this particular region of his brain, there are certain cells that seem only to be responding to this kind of rotational motion, right? His yaw, to use the term the pilots would use. And so, of course, yaw you can reproduce just by taking him and spinning. So that's the first experiment. You can imagine that being sure that you actually have an electrode, a little piece of wire, right next to a cell that's very small, sitting in the black of the fly's head, while he's spinning at couple thousand degrees per second and making rapid turns, this isn't so easy. So you start with just one dimension, and eventually one will get further. So this is it. What you see, the electrical signal that you pick up, looks like this. You see the little rumbling in the background. And then these are these discrete pulses called action potentials or spikes that come from this particular neuron, which is sensitive to motion in one particular direction. And of course, if you put your electrode somewhere else, you can pick up signals from other neurons. So to revisit, this is an attempt to show you what the fly is looking at, right? So if you put a camera on the motor drive with the fly, if you really did that, things would blur a lot, because of course the fly is moving fast. And the sound you're hearing is this electrical signal, the analog of what you're hearing from my arm, but now coming from this particular cell. And hopefully you'll notice that when things go in one direction, you tend to hear lots of stuff. And in the other direction, not so much. But actually, that's a little hard to figure out just by watching. So, well, what can one do with this kind of experiment? Well, the fly's doing at least two different things here. One is that he has to take all the signals in the retina and actually figure out how fast he's turning. And the other thing he has to do is sort of write down the answer in this funny sequence of pulses. And I'm actually not going to talk at all about the problem of how you take the signal and turn it into the spikes. I want to talk just about the problem of computing motion. So this is, again, one of these problems, like the problem of seeing a few photons in the dark, or counting molecules in the bacteria, or estimating the delay of the echo for the bat. This is a problem where there's a limit to how well you can do that comes from fairly basic physical principles. The photons are arriving at random in the retina, just like they do for us. There's a little extra noise in the receptor cells. The image of the world is very blurry because of these small lenses. And so there's a limit to how well you can do. And you can calculate what that limit is. And in fact, if you read out the signal from the neuron, the cell that we were just listening to, you can estimate how fast the fly is turning. And then you can ask, how good is your estimate compared to this limit that you calculate? And in fact, they're very close. And in fact, that means that you're detecting motions which are much smaller than the spacing between the cells in the retina. So it is as if you were taking a picture with a digital camera and you could see that things had moved over by 1/10 of a pixel. Which, by the way, you can do in your eye too. And it's a collection of phenomena which are called hyperacuity. And actually, although the history is complicated, the experiments in this system that Rob did during his thesis years may be the first example of that phenomenon seen in the responses of single neurons. But as I say, for us, maybe the striking thing is that this is close to these physical limits. In these beautiful experiments that Rob's been doing outside, you can really see that when it's brighter outside, you might have thought, okay, all this story about photons arriving at random, that's important at midnight. But, you know, flies fly around at 2 in the afternoon. What difference does it make? There's lots of photons. Yeah, and there are more at noon. And you can see that these neurons are more reliable at noon than they are at 2 in the afternoon. That last factor of 10 or so actually helps. The system's using all of the available physical signal. Now, if you actually want to do that, it matters how you compute motion. There are lots of ways you could compute motion that give you a signal that's pretty good. But there's really only one way to do it that will give you a signal that's as good as possible. And so that's a problem that we worked on theoretically. And as you can see by reading the dates, it took 10 years to finally show that that is actually what the fly does. And so I'm not going to take you through what happened in the intervening 10 years. It's sort of painful. Never mind. But I do want to give one illustration, because there's a confusion, which is that you might think that if you're doing the best possible job, you're using all of the signal that's there, and you're being as reliable as you can be, then of course you'll always get the right answer. And that's not true. Doing as well as you can is an average concept. You can't do perfectly because the signals aren't perfect to start out with. So just like in many situations in life, what you have to do is to decide what set of conditions you want to work under, what are your ideas about what might actually be happening, and you try to do the best on average under those conditions. And that means that I might be able to show you something drawn, as it were, from a slightly unusual situation in which you'll do something dramatically wrong. So you might have the perfect investment strategy for a stock market that's behaving a certain way, and then something happens, and it's not the perfect strategy anymore. You weren't wrong for the 6 months before, but now you're in a slightly different world, and you'll get the wrong answer. In this problem, I can create worlds that the flies, or you, have never encountered. right? I can make something completely artificial. And so there's no reason that the fly should get it right, and no reason that you should get it right. However, if I know what the fly or you are doing, I should be able to predict what you're going to do when you make the mistake. So what I'm going to do is to show you a visual input that if you're doing a computation that is like the computation that we think the fly is doing in order to generate the best possible estimate of motion, you'll see something moving. I assure you there's nothing moving, and I'll explain what's going on. Let's just watch for a moment, and then I'll tell you what you were watching. So hopefully, you saw things move. Now, what are you looking at? This is a whole lot of little squares, pixels, and their intensities have been set to random levels. And as time goes on, they're going to flicker, and they flicker completely at random. There is nothing orderly about what's going on. It's like tuning the television set in between the channels, right? Back when you could tune television sets, but yeah. Can't do that anymore. Have to come up with a new analogy. You all remember, right? And on this side, you're also going to see pixels flickering completely at random. Now, if you were really good, which I don't think you can do this, what you would find is that what you see here is delayed or advanced, I don't remember which, by one frame relative to what's happening here. So this is a completely random movie. And this is the same completely random movie shifted forward in time by one video frame. Okay? Remember the screen's being redrawn at 30 times a second or whatever, right? So one video frame ahead is the movie over here. So what I'm going to do is to take these things, and they start like this, and then they move together, and then at some point they're on top of each other. And what you see in every pixel is just the sum. The brightness of every pixel is just the sum of the pixel that came from here and the pixel that came from there. Okay? And so what does that mean? It means that there's a little bit of an effect where the contribution from this pixel at one time is going to be the same as what this pixel was a little time earlier or later. Right? It's not that it's exactly the same. It's not that the pixel moved over, right? Because you're putting these two noisy things on top of each other. But there's a little bit of correlation that's separated in space and in time. And the optimal strategy for estimating motion actually involves picking up that correlation. And because you do that computation, you think you see something moving. And so when they're far apart, of course, well, right? When they're far apart, it doesn't work. But when the displacements aren't too big, then you see something moving. And of course, if the displacement gets smaller, then the speed slows down, right? Because the time difference stayed the same, but the space difference got smaller, so the speed went down. And then if we displace to the other side, it moves the other way. Now, what's really striking, and I should have brought the demonstration, is that the theory predicts not only that you'll see this move in the way that I described, but suppose that over here, instead of just delaying things, I also inverted black for white and all the gray levels in between. Then if you work through the theory, remember, the displacement in time is the same, the displacement in space is the same. The only thing I'm going to do is to flip black for white. But if you sort of work through the math, the prediction is you should see it move the other way. And you do. And so does the fly. And gradually, well, it's a bit of a cheat to say because of experiments like this, but from this general direction, it's finally been possible to dissect much of this structure by which the fly actually estimates motion. Many people have contributed to that. and important features of the predictions of theory, what the fly should be doing in order to generate the best possible estimate, have actually been confirmed. And a number of other authors have pointed out that if you use the same theoretical principles to think about problems of how we perceive motion, then you can also predict a number from the same principles that you're trying to do the best job on average, you can predict a number of other places where your estimate of motion will fail. And these are, of course, called illusions. So, we've seen a few examples, right? We've talked about photon counting in vision, talked about molecule counting in bacteria, echo timing in bats, symmetry perception. I mentioned the problem of pitch perception for complex sounds, and we spent a little time on the problem of motion estimation. And what all of these problems have in common is that the performance of the system is very close to the limits that are set by basic physical principles. And to drive this home, let me emphasize that what this means is that you can sit down with an understanding of the physics of the signals that arrive at the fly's eye and calculate something about what you will find when you record from a neuron that is many layers deep inside the fly's brain, and you will get it right. And you did not make a model of all the things that happen in between. What you did was to understand very well the physics at the input and the kind of problem that the fly is actually trying to solve. And that idea that combining an understanding of the kind of problem the brain is trying to solve with the physical constraints that we operate in, the world that we live in, the idea that by putting those together in the right way, you might actually generate an understanding, or at least a partial understanding, of how the brain actually works, that's a very appealing idea, I think, to physicists, and it's an idea that's excited many people in many different directions. And there are many other examples of this style of reasoning, many of which happen to be represented among visitors to a program at the Institute at the moment. So some of them are here, and they'd kill me if I didn't mention this, but it's also to emphasize that I've chosen one path through this set of ideas, and you could have chosen many other paths, but the spirit would always be the same. This combination of understanding what kind of problem you're trying to solve and what are the physical principles that govern how well you can do and what it is possible and not possible for you to do, that somehow biology has found a way to operate at the margins of what is allowed. And that's a place where you can make predictions. Okay? If I tell you that, you know, it's consistent with what's allowed, of course it's consistent with what's allowed. You don't really believe that biology violates the laws of physics. It's not helpful. Well, at a certain time in history, it was very helpful, but at the moment, it's not a very quantitative prediction. If, on the other hand, I tell you that biology operates right at the edge of what's possible, I can calculate where that edge is. And I can predict what I'll find in a system that operates at that edge. So taking this idea of optimality, operating near the edge, I can predict what I should find inside the box when I open it up, or when I probe it in interesting ways like the stimulus that I showed you. And that's actually led, that style of reasoning has led to a number of new discoveries, predictions that have been confirmed about what you find in this mysterious box that we call the brain. And so I want to leave you with this spirit that somehow, through the process of evolution, nature has found ways of performing, building brains, building sensory systems, building processing systems in the brain that operate very close to the limits of what the laws of physics allow. But I also want to raise some flags. This is a collection of examples. One of the really difficult things for a physicist confronting the phenomena of life is how you manage to say something general. Not wanting to offend some of my colleagues, let me be careful how I say it. It has been remarked that the boundary between the theory of everything and the theory of nothing is not very often not very distinct. It's very important that, you know, if you set out to have a theory of all how all brains work, you know, you're gonna figure everything out, but somehow you never calculate anything about any particular neuron in any particular brain, it's not clear whether you've actually done anything. So on the one hand, in order to ground yourself, you want to study some particular examples. But then you want to know, how do you generalize from those to ask whether you've discovered a general principle or not? One way that's been very successful in biology is discovering that the molecular mechanisms tend to be universal. So the molecules that are in the brain of that fly that allow its neurons to do its thing, and the molecules that are in our brain that allow our neurons to do their same thing, are, to a very good approximation, the same. They're obviously arranged a little differently, but they're the same molecules. They are recognizably related to each other. What we're asking here is whether there are general principles, and I think this goes throughout the interests of physicists in biology at this point, whether there are general principles about how the whole system works together. And these notions of optimization is one possible example. But there's another problem, and that is we have a theory for what algorithm the bat should use to compute the distance to the target. And we have a theory for how you should compute pitch from the component frequencies, and we have a theory for how flies should compute motion, and so on. And this is in danger of becoming a laundry list as opposed to a theory. And so there's a question of whether not only are these observations of optimality more general, but is there something about the kinds of problems that the nervous system is solving which is the same in all these cases, so that you could really have a theory of all of these things rather than just a collection of little theories of the individual things. And maybe with the dream that many of us share that one can find that, I'll stop. Thanks very much.
Well, as usual, before refreshments in the common room, we have time for questions. So let me pass you the microphone before you.
I'm curious if you have done any studies on the effectiveness of having to use such horrendously large numbers of individual cells, like 10 to the ninth. What advantage does that give if you are an order of magnitude less?
It's a great question. Think about how to answer it. But one view, which is surprisingly popular, I think, of what we do with all the neurons that we have in our head. So as was mentioned in the question, we have billions of individual neurons in our head. The joke is that there are 10 to the 10th neurons in your brain, of which 10 to the 11th are found in the cerebellum. One surprisingly popular idea is that you average over them, that the signals from the individual cells are lousy, and you need to collect lots of them. I personally find this very hard to believe. And actually, it's clear that when you do experiments, it's much easier to convince yourself that things are sloppy than it is to convince yourself that things are precise. Because all you have to do to make them sloppy is not control everything. And you know, when you have a big, complicated brain, what does it mean to control everything? I can show you the same movie, but I can't guarantee that you're thinking the same thoughts, right? So it's not like, you know, I drop something and I pick it up and I drop it again. I show you a movie and I show you the movie again. I don't know if you're in the same state. Now, in fact, there are beautiful experiments demonstrating that in the same way that you can correlate your perception with the activity of individual cells in your fingertips, you can also correlate, under certain constrained conditions, the perceptions that a monkey will report with the activity of individual neurons in his central nervous system, okay, where there are billions of cells. The correlations are perhaps not quite as tight, so even the simplest percepts seem to involve, as it were, listening to 100 cells. But it's not the case that in order to get anything, you have to average over 1,000 cells. Now, the hard part is that there are some regions of your brain that are just gigantic, and it's really difficult to understand what you're doing with all those cells. And I think that's a real challenge. I mean, there are ideas, but it's a real issue. It's of course true that there are other animals that solve many of the same problems with fewer cells. The real question you want to ask is, what's the extra thing we can do? You don't want to ask a monkey, or us, which is the same thing actually for most of these purposes, how they solve a problem that a frog can solve, or a fly can solve. Because if you do that, you're obviously not asking about the things that we can do with these extra cells that they can't. Right? So you somehow have to find, you have to make precise these very hard problems that we're capable of solving, and ask about those. And it's very difficult. But it appears that every single one of those billions of neurons is actually making a measurable contribution. I don't know if that's satisfying, but that's the best I can do.
When I was an undergraduate, we had an exercise in how to go beyond the so-called five senses. And one that we came up with first was kinesthesia. That is, if you put your hand behind your back, how do you know where it is? And my question is, if that is a problem, what sort of applications could be drawn from that? If we knew, for example, exactly how to tell where it is, it might have military applications.
So, I actually, I presume that I have the usual level of human interest in human physiology, but I don't actually have a professional interest in it. So I'm not an expert. My understanding is that there isn't a problem in the sense that you have lots of receptors. We don't usually think about it, but you have lots of receptors that, for example, are measuring the tension in your muscles and I guess they're not really measuring joint angles. They're measuring strains. And so you have access through these sensors to things about the states of your muscles from which you could presumably figure out where things are. Now, I actually don't know much about how it's done. I think the point is that for a long time it was believed that those signals were used only in very local feedback loops to help you actually control things. And the fact that you could become conscious of it, as it were, was kind of surprising. But I don't know that we should be too worried about that. And I shudder to think what one would do with a better understanding of this.
Now, this is an electrical engineer question, but you demonstrated that when you move your hand, you created electrical energy. Electrical energy, as we all know, radiates. And mm-hmm. You demonstrated that the eye can detect as small as a single photon. And it's in the presence of this radiating energy.
Mm-hmm. you're worried about interference. So,
well, I'm worried. I guess you could.
Okay.
If
so,
you wanted to extend it, it'd be to telepathy.
Yeah. Right. So, it's funny. This question's come up a lot in conversations recently. So there are two issues here. Okay. One is that not only am I able to detect these incredibly small signals coming from the outside world, I'm also able to do it while I'm doing all sorts of stuff, right? And presumably that generates confounding signals. Now, that's actually not a big problem in your eye. It's not that big a problem in your ear because you're listening for sounds at, 400 cycles per second and above or something like that. And, you don't really move your head at that frequency, so it's okay. The place where it really becomes significant is for fish that try to detect prey by measuring the electric fields produced by the muscles of the prey. So what you could think about, of course, is that if I were swimming around in this water, I am presumably producing all the time the electrical signal that I just picked up. And perhaps a shark could notice this. He does. Sharks and other fish have electroreceptors that are very sensitive precisely for that reason. Now, they're, of course, tuned to a range of frequencies that corresponds to the signals that animals make with their muscles. there's a remarkable story about how sensitive these things are and so on. You know, a shark can measure the inductive electric field that results from the fact that they're swimming through the Earth's magnetic field. And, you know, how does that work, right? That's a good physics problem. How do those detectors work? Now there are two interesting issues here. One is, of course, that the signals that he makes with his own muscles by swimming, and in fact by breathing, are larger than this, by orders of magnitude. And so, in some fish at least, it's clear that what they do is learn the pattern of electrical signals that will appear at their receptors as a result of their own breathing and subtract that away. And you can change what that would be just by changing their environment. Because of course, I mean, they move their muscles around, that generates currents, they flow out in the environment, complicated things happen, and they produce voltages at their receptors. So if I stick a rock over here, I actually change what the electric field will be here as a result of my breathing. So I actually have to learn something about how to do the subtraction. And dogfish, which don't look like particularly smart creatures, in fact can do this. Now, so that's one set of questions related to sort of the consequence of this. The telepathy one is kind of interesting. If we had electroreceptors that were as sensitive as these fish, then I'm pretty sure that if I were sitting next to you in a swimming pool, I could measure some aspect of your brainwaves. Now, it's not out of the range of possibility. Now, A, we don't have these, okay? However attractive it might be, we don't have them, as far as anybody knows. It's also true that what you could measure would be very crude, right? Because you're measuring some average voltage coming out of your brain. And in fact, you do that, it's called the EEG, right? I could put electrodes on your scalp and I can see what I can measure. And you can either view it that it's remarkable that you can measure anything so specific, or it's disappointing that you measure something so crude. So if you were hoping to read my mind, it's disturbingly crude and you're never going to get anywhere. On the other hand, if you wanted to know whether I was thinking about anything or not, you can actually do that. This is classic demonstration by Adrian, where he sits there and, you know, he closes his eyes and you have the two electrodes sitting here, and what you see is the alpha rhythm in the electrical signals, right? And then someone asks him, you know, what's 42 plus 17? And the pattern changes because he's thinking about it. So you can pick up something crude from the outside that's related to your thoughts, but, you know, if they'd asked him what was 42 plus 19, I don't know that you could have told the difference, right? That he wasn't just sitting there calmly, but was in fact thinking about something is detectable. Exactly what he was thinking surely is not detectable from the outside.
Have you been able to find any organisms that do not seem to be optimized near the quantum limit?
So, look, let me give you a simple example. Let's talk about our own vision, not at night, but during the day, in the cones. I don't understand why the noise level in cones is as high as it is. And I don't think anybody really does. I mean, there are arguments for why it should be higher, but it's not clear what constraint is forcing it to be where it is. I mean, obviously, you don't want them to be as sensitive as rods because you want them to run during the day where there are lots of photons. But given that statement, why are they, I mean, they're not bad, but it's not clear what sets the limit. And so we simply don't know whether there's any sensible physical limit there or not. So that's an example where there's no obvious calculation you can do that would generate a limit where the system seems to be operating. Given the noise level in the cones, there are many aspects of your vision that appear to be nearly optimal, but I don't understand the noise level in the cones.
But Bill, if we've evolved, evolution has, seeks optimality and achieves it often. Since it's an ongoing process, it must be the case that in many organisms, you
absolutely
find many systems that are not yet there,
right,
are suboptimal.
Sure.
And if you didn't, in fact,
you'd be a little worried.
You'd be a little worried, right?
Right. So, it's certainly true that you know, there are some things that it looks like nature got right a long time ago, and been fiddling with a little bit ever since. But in some sense, the basics for doing very, very well were established very long ago. And I don't know whether that means that those were easy problems for nature to solve or what, but it seems to be true. So, you know, there are bacteria which can count single photons so that they can swim towards the light. And they do it slightly different ways, but not infinitely different. There are also questions. On the other hand, there are things that have evolved relatively recently, one presumes, or at least our ways of doing them that have evolved relatively recently, which we also do nearly optimally, estimating probabilities from examples, things like that. So I don't really know how to think about it. I mean, I think that I mean, I'm still, I think that the ideas have been productive in the sense that they force you to think very carefully about what problem it is the system's really solving, which is often a hard question in and of itself. That there are systems which are surely not optimized has to be true. On the other hand, it is perhaps a sign of the productiveness of the idea that quantitative departures from optimality actually seem interesting. Something actually Boris worked on with respect to adaptation and photoreceptors. So I don't know. I mean, I left it as a question as to whether this is really general or not, because I really don't know. It's been fun to explore examples where things are optimized, and it's been interesting that some of the things that one learns seem to be more general. That is to say, that there are cases where it seems hard to demonstrate that things are optimized, but it nonetheless seems to work the same way. It's going to how to make this transition from the particular to the general is a real challenge in this field.
If you look at a PET scan, and humans doing individual computations, you'll see quite different glucose uptake mm-hmm. patterns in different people. What do you attribute that to?
So
you see them doing something relatively simple, such as addition or subtraction.
Right. Well, there's two kinds of answers. One is that there's actually, let me back up. If you talk to the evolutionary biologists, they also are, there are evolutionary biologists who are very strong advocates of the idea that the history of evolution is largely driven by adaptation, and that you're driving toward at least local optimization. And there are other people saying, no, you never get there, you're stuck with your history, you can't escape it, and so on. One argument that's sometimes offered is that if things were optimized, then all animals would do it the same way. That's actually not true. It depends, you say, what you mean by optimized. So for instance, I could tell you that, to use an example of things that have floated around in the workshop that we've been having, that I really want to be sure that you're doing as well as you can, given, in your example, how much energy you're expending. Because after all, when you're measuring glucose uptake, you're actually measuring how hard you're working, right? You're measuring energy expenditure of the cells. Sure. Yeah, well, I mean, there's an issue of where it comes from. But roughly speaking, you're talking about energy expenditure. Now, I can say that perhaps the brain has evolved to solve certain problems as well as you can given how much energy you expend. But I haven't told you how much energy you should expend. I've told you, given that, you know, it's kind of like spending money on technology, right? There's dollars and there's performance. And what you want to do is make sure you maximize your performance given how many dollars you spend. But I can't tell you that you were wrong to spend $500 less for your computer or $500 more. On the other hand, if two people both spent the same amount, I could tell you who got more computational power. So one can think of optimization as a family of solutions, right? Given how much you spend, you want to have the best performance you can. And it's possible that different individuals have chosen different operating points along this in the way that we do when we buy things. And it's not, if I want to understand whether everybody should choose the same operating point, I actually have to understand something about how they compete with each other for resources outside, and that's a very complicated problem. But in terms of the design of the brain, it's possible that we've all optimized something and have chosen different operating points along a single optimal curve. And actually, interestingly, in the fly's visual system, you can get close to that question. These neurons that are sensitive to motion, they come with names and numbers. They're sufficiently similar from individual to individual within the same species of fly that you can find the same neuron anatomically. However, its response properties are very similar. However, they are not identical. And so if you show the same movie to a dozen flies of the same species, and you record from what's supposed to be the same neuron, you'll find that the detailed pattern, the general pattern of the pulses that come out are the same. The detailed pattern is different. However, what you find is that in a part of the problem I didn't talk about, if you ask a question which is sort of how efficiently are they using the patterns to represent information about what they're looking at, the answer is they all do it with essentially the same efficiency. However, they've each captured a slightly different amount and actually slightly different features of the information that's coming in. So there's something which seems to be universal and something which seems to be individual.
And as a species, that might be the optimal distribution.
Right. But in order to ask whether that was a good idea or not, you actually have to do a very different kind of problem. It's not a problem about processing information locally. It's about how you and your neighbors interact. And, you know, I'm a physicist. I can't do that. It's too hard.
Okay, on that note of humility,
that's rare note of humility.
And retire to refreshment.